everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. We're going to continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. The topic, the localization movement, meaning to shift global and corporate power back to the people and the communities. My two panelists today will be Helena Norberg-Hodge. She is from overseas. She's visiting New York. And she is an author, activist, filmmaker, who is regarded by many as a pioneer of the global localization movement. Earth Journal included Helena among its top 10 leading environmentalists worldwide. She's fluent in many languages. She studied in her native Sweden, Germany, Austria, England, and the United States, specializing in linguistics, including studies at MIT with Noam Chomsky since 1975. Helena has worked with the people of the Lakota or the Little Tibet in the western Indian Himalayas to find ways of enabling its ancient culture to meet the pressures from the modern world without sacrificing its social and ecological values. And for these efforts, she was awarded the Right Livelihood Award, or the Alternative Nobel Prize. Helena is the founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture, based in the United States and United Kingdom, which examines the root causes of our current social and environmental crisis while promoting more sustainable and equitable patterns of living. She's also a founding member of the International Commission for the Future of Food and Agriculture, as well as being a co-founder of both the International Forum on Globalization and the Global Eco Village Network. Her book, Ancient Futures, has been described as an inspirational classic, and her documentary, Economics of Happiness, has received international acclaim. She's currently visiting the United States, and her website is localfutures.org. And she'll be joining us in just a moment. Also on our panel today is a person that some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with his work, Charles Eisenstein. He is in Nashville, North Carolina. He's an independent scholar and an author, and he writes about human culture and identity and economics and evolution of the human cultures and the spiritual challenges of coping with the society and world in chaos. In the past, he has taught at Goddard College, Penn State University, and he's lived in and with the Chinese people for many years. He has degrees in mathematics and philosophy from Yale University and has been active with other visionaries to develop progressive models of business and charity based upon deeper ethical standards. He is the author of several books, the most popular being Sacred Economics, as well as The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, which is a collection of essays which offers an alternative story of humanity as an antidote to the malaise and frustration and paralysis preventing people from being vehicles for change. His website is Charles Eisenstein, EISENSTEIN.net. I'd like to welcome both of you to our program today.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yes, thank you, Gary.
Good. I want to ask each of you to address the following issue, which to me is very important. And if you listen to the show at all, you know that I do very little talking. I don't chit-chat. Instead, I lay out larger, overarching themes. Accept any part of that theme that you would like to address, then take it as in-depth as you wish. We prefer the deeper, more meaningful answer, so please don't feel rushed at all. Now, although we continue to speak about globalization as if it were a process that is still underway, it's not. I feel it's time that we were finally, as a society, open and honest and accept the fact that we are in a state of globalization and have been for a long time. It is the way the world works today, unfortunately. And the intricate network of central banks around the world are wired all together. And privatization is the rule for developmental aid to developing nations. If you don't want to become privatized, you don't get aid. In fact, you're frequently ostracized. If you have precious minerals of some type that someone needs, then you are a concern, and therefore they bring forth the people who try to manipulate governments or heads of governments or most vulnerable in governments to say, take on the issue that we want. Allow us a private-public partnership. Allow us to build our infrastructures, the roads we need to go from a port. We'll build a port. We'll build a road. We'll build everything we need to extract what we want. In the interim, you'll become as wealthy as you want to be. And that's the backstory. I know that because I've spoken with people who've been involved in those discussions, including John Perkins. But privatization, unfortunately, is everywhere. Think of how invested interest in vulture firms are now trying to capitalize and bleed Puerto Rico even further after the human crisis, after the Hurricane Irma. Countries can do little without the approval of a small, select group of Western governments and large multinational corporations like Monsanto and Cargo and the large fossil fuel industries and commodity traders and hedge funds and equity partners and vulture capitalists and the huge international NGOs such as the Bill Gates and the Clinton Foundations. They only favor private interests more than real people. That's my personal opinion. But progress as defined by modern industrial culture is relentless. It's impersonal. And it is unidirectional. It can be slowed at times, but never truly reversed. It can never be completely reformed. And yet we're told, vote Democrat. And any of the bad things you don't like about the Democratic Party swing to the right or their corporatization policy or neoliberal policies, that'll all be worked out. We'll get a committee together. We'll put some liberals, progressives on there, and everything will be worked out. Nothing's ever worked out. So when it is planned and carefully controlled, it's like a river that has been artificially straightened and forced to flow between levees. It loses its heart. Try to stop modern capitalist progress, and we're most often pushed aside. And then you dam it up with protest, and it flows into other paths, like festering polluted water. It hates to be controlled. It refuses control. It refuses oversight unless it controls the agencies of oversight. So when we speak about grassroots movements, which is the theme of our program, to localize economies, are we not speaking about a necessary peaceful rebellion to emerge from the bottom up to challenge corporate globalization and the NGOs and the banks and everyone else involved? And yet to be actually effective, is it reasonable to ask, must it not take place within a ruling globalized order? And in your answer, please explain to us what is meant by localization of economics. The form is yours, and if you don't mind, we will, whichever one of you would like to start, please take the form, and then the other can have the form after that. Helena, would you like to start, please?
Sure. Yes, well, I'm happy to. I agree with almost everything you said, Gary, but a few differences. And one of them is, you know, when we say, you know, we are in a globalized world, we are in a globalizing world whereby giant mobile banks and corporations are continuing to pressure national governments to open up even more, to extract their resources, as you said, and to extract cheap labor. And all the time, this process of globalization is one whereby these giants, these monopolies, are being given more freedom. That's what free trade is, global free trade. What most people don't understand is that those same corporations pressured those very same governments to over-regulate their national and local businesses. And so we're having a process of simultaneous over-regulation at the local level, particularly of farmers, but small businesses, small farmers, while the giants that are monopolies are being liberated and deregulated. At the same time, nation states are squeezing their citizens and place-based or localized businesses within their national boundaries for more and more tax. Those taxes turn around and become subsidies for giant monopolies. So I would argue that the system is so completely skewed, it is not actually following any sort of neoliberal thinking. The neoliberals are not actually seeing the reality of what they've been pushing for. And in fact, I think we at the grassroots have not done the job we need to do to really lay out how this system works. So I believe that with a big picture analysis, really laying on the table what this system means to squeeze and tax the small and turn around and subsidize the monopolies, to squeeze and destroy the real economy. And by the way, a lot of conservatives who live in rural areas know that their economy comes from the plants and the animals and from the living earth. Again, to squeeze that and to destroy, as we speak, you know, species, to poison water. Again, I do not think that this is an issue that is left or right. And I believe that our biggest problem is that we have allowed a model of progress to proceed which has encouraged and which has been built on ever more narrow, reductionist, mechanistic thinking, where people have become more and more blind as they supported a giant system whereby they're strangling themselves. And I think so it's this combination of blindness linked to large scale, and it's been particularly tragic to see Western environmental groups end up manipulated, often by corporate-funded think tanks, for instance, to lobby for this idea that poor countries shouldn't need to reduce CO2 emissions at the same rate as rich countries. Now, this is a corporate agenda. The corporations, with globalization, were moving their big factories to the so-called poor countries to create slave-like factories. They needed lots of fossil fuels and needed to be able to pollute over there. And then you had well-intentioned environmentalists in the West lobbying for this. You know, so to me, it's so much about blindness. It's so much about a lack of a bigger picture that is allowing this system to continue, which, by the way, also, Gary, now what's happening is that big business are way ahead of the grassroots movement. They can see that people are getting pretty fed up with this and that there is an attempt to protect their national concerns, which, of course, is described as something very nasty, to be protectionist. We need to turn all this language around and say, of course, we should all be protecting our jobs, our environment, our cultures. But anyway, now big business is coming back home. They are localizing, but now they're using robots instead of people. So we need to step back and look at how an energy-intensive, resource-intensive, fundamentally fossil fuel-based system has been destroying the environment and destroying jobs. We need to have what I call big picture activism, which is partly what you're doing on your show, for which I'm very grateful. We need to get this message out urgently. At the same time, what we've been doing in my organization, Local Futures, is to alert people to the fact that there is actually a huge amount to be gained by going local right now, especially around food. Farmers and consumers and enlightened middlemen, or middle women, if you like, are getting together and creating smaller scale, human scale business structures linked to the resources on the ground. So it's happening in forestry, fishery, other forms of farming, fiber, you know, everything we need obviously comes from the earth. And as we start localizing, we start waking up to the realities of diversity, of the uniqueness of place, and of the incredible increase in productivity, increase in the sense of community, increase in the number of meaningful livelihoods, of jobs, the localization movement offers. So there is actually, Gary, there is something going on out there the way I would differ with you, I would say globalization and these giant corporations are not the only show in town. Worldwide, I am amazed. Partly we've helped to pioneer a lot of this from China and Japan to South America and Europe and North America. And we are quite unusual in that we have worked at the grassroots globally and literally, you know, with farmers and consumers. And we, even though we've helped to pioneer this, every time we come back to a given region, you know, including in the United States right now, where we're having four Economics of Happiness conferences, and the feedback we get is really truly inspiring to see how much is happening without any help from government, no help from mainstream media, virtually no money. And it's amazing how much is happening. There is a global local food movement that's gaining strength despite this heavy top-down corporate capitalist system. And it's not so much about private versus not private. It's about scale. It's about community. And you can have lots of privately owned businesses that operate within the social and ecological framework that keeps them healthy, keeps them, you know, authentic and accountable, and that can be absolutely fine. So anyway, there's a lot really, I suppose I would say, ultimately, nature and people are the real force, and we can have blinded people pushing a monocultural top-down system, and they can keep pushing, and yes, they can still destroy a lot, but ultimately, nature and people will win out. And one final thought, too, I just want to say, you know, we should also realize that as this system supports fewer and fewer people, it means our side is gaining power and momentum because, you know, the losers in this game now, it is, of course, 100% of humanity because we are threatening to extinguish ourselves. But, you know, in a monetary sense, when you have five men owning more than half the global population, well, then maybe we, you know, the 99% are being a little bit stupid to allow this system to continue. So we've just got to, I think, wake up to the bigger picture, take action at the local level to join the localization movement. But maybe I didn't quite answer your question, because part of what has to happen is we do need to see what kind of international collaboration we're going to need in order to take back control of these mobile businesses. And that's going to be through new treaties with civic society at the table, demanding that we re-regulate and stop subsidizing giant monopolies. We don't have to, you know, shoot an arrow through the heart of Monsanto and kill it, because obviously we can't, but we can raise the awareness, bring up the numbers, and start ending this criminal injustice. And I hope I have another chance to come back, because I want to talk about some of the movements, like the Five Star Movement in Italy, that are showing models for how we can take back political power.
You've made some extremely important and salient points, and I would agree with everything you just said. I possibly did not fully explain my opening overarching comment that the world today is a globalized society, and that's only because it's only the globalized part of it that ever gets the media's attention, the praise, as if that's a model we should all be following. You're absolutely correct. In every country of the world, there are movements that, for example, in Russia, we can demonize Russia, but Vladimir Putin has made a point to say he is against NGOs and is going to become the world's largest producer of organic produce. On all other topics, you could agree or disagree with him and how he runs his government. But on that one alone, think if the whole world took one lesson, but we don't listen to that. Americans never told that. For example, I just was at the Dallas food market. Now, for a long time, it was the largest open-air market in the United States. It consisted of six large buildings about the size of airplane hangars. It was huge. And that farmer's market was made up of little, little farms, some 1 acre, half acre, 2 acres, but they all had something in common. They were growing something locally, supplying it to a local market 7 days a week, every day of the year. And when I went back there, they had developers had come in and taken over 90% of it. There was only one building remaining, and it had maybe 100 stalls and a little 10-foot booths. But here's what was important. The developers bought it and then put up beautiful townhouses surrounding, like, I walked the whole distance. I was curious, how big is this area that they just developed? It used to be nobody would live there. And now it's packed with young, educated people. So I went over to the guy at the farmer's market. Now, he looked the same. I remember from long beard, and he looked like something out of American Gothic, you know, holding a pitchfork. And he was selling honey and vegetables. I said, how are you doing? He said, pretty good. I said, I'm just curious. I said, I've been coming here a long time. And how's the flow of people now versus when it used to? You had the whole area here. He said, oh, we might have 12 to 14,000 people on a Saturday. I said, you're kidding. He said, no. I said, it's more than what they had before. He said, yes, because the people coming tend to be younger, more educated, and they want organic. They don't want GMO. They want local honey. They don't want something that's been made in China and sugared, watered down. So he said, we had a long conversation. He said that even as the market itself shrunk because of developers, the people who then went to live in the development are now re-supporting the market as never before. And that is happening in Boulder, in Los Angeles, all across America. When I travel, I see the movement of people trying to support local vegan restaurants. I'm a vegan. Local vegan restaurants. And used to be, you couldn't have one vegan restaurant on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. The most densely populated group of people of success in the world, between 57th Street and 125th Street, between Central Park and Hudson River, that was the greatest concentration of successful business people, artists, academics, Columbia University, Barnard, Teachers College, all up there. They wouldn't support one place. Now, within four blocks, there are four vegan restaurants. Within four blocks. And they're all packed all the time. So I think we have to take what you said as just the tip of an iceberg, because the media has not been giving it the attention it deserves. We're going to come back with you to continue that, but I want to go over to Charles. Charles, would you please lay out your larger view and add into anything that Helena said that would give us even greater depth of awareness of localization?
Well, I'll try. I've been really impressed by everything that's been said so far and feeling really grateful that the deeper systemic analysis is present on a progressive radio show, because so often what's called progressive takes for granted pretty much everything that the corporatocracy and mainstream media present and just tries to make it a little bit better within that range. So one thing you mentioned was this seemingly inevitable process of globalization that really takes for granted the very thing that we have to change. I've been researching a book on climate change, and pretty much everything I read says, we know that by the year 2050, 70% of all humans will live in cities. Like, this urbanization is taken as an inevitable thing. But it is actually not inevitable. It is a choice that is created or dictated by the economic system that we have chosen and the financial system underneath it. I've been on a bit of a news fast recently to pull back, because a lot of what is presented as the headlines, no matter which side that you take, and there might be both sides presented in liberal and conservative news outlets, there's an implicit communication that this is the most important thing that you could be caring about right now. But in fact, everything that is actually important very rarely makes the headlines. Like, what you were saying about the organic food push in Russia. Like, that was the first time I'd ever heard of that.
Yeah, me too. I never heard of that either.
Yeah. So the stuff that is the most significant is going on underneath the surface that we don't find out about. And even though, like, my news reading habits were mostly far left, I would visit other things just to kind of know what was going on, but I would read, you know, things like Counterpunch and Alternet and stuff like that. Even so, I was realizing that my own biases about what was important were filtering the news, and I was getting more and more entrenched in my own customary way of seeing things. So I'm not advocating that everybody stop becoming informed about the world, but it is sometimes good to take a pause and to deprogram from the things that we think are inevitable. So in climate, this has been coming up so strongly, where the pro and con, the debate, so-called, is about whether or the extent to which carbon emissions are making our future uninhabitable. And what's left out is the effect of local ecocide, especially deforestation and soil erosion and biodiversity loss, the effect of that on drought, on flooding, on temperature. This, in my research, I've discovered is more important than global emissions, that if we don't stop doing that, if we don't stop cutting forests and plowing up land and draining wetlands especially and overfishing the oceans, if we don't stop doing that, then even if we cut emissions to zero, the planet dies a death of a million cuts. So this overarching issue, this global issue of reducing emissions, where you can plant one forest here and cut it down another one there and shift the pieces around, that also is, even like, that's part of the problem too. Even this one global issue that seems to trump everything else and which invites us to give even more power to the global institutions that can administer a global solution, even that is not something we should take for granted. So the movement to the local, you know, when I was listening to Helena, my inner cynic came up and said, but this, you know, this local food movement, local economy movement, yeah, but if it's all happening inside the current financial system, it's swimming upstream. And it's like you were saying, you know, you dam it up in one place and the desperate compulsion of global capital to find some other high return, high yield investment, which means is you know, it bursts out somewhere else, which means basically finding some other source of true wealth to convert into financial wealth somewhere where there's still natural resources to exploit. And if you won't let us do it in the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge, then we'll go to Afghanistan and we'll extract it from there. And so I don't believe my own inner cynic, because I think that by aligning ourselves with the future that we want to see, we change the conditions that ultimately give rise to our politics and our institutions. And we come into it's almost like a ritual or a prayer where we say, here is the world that I want to live in. Here is a little piece of it that I see and that I can take that step. And then that opens up often a deeper radicalism, because maybe then you see that it's not just a matter of buying from your local farmer when your local farmer tells you about the regulatory pressure he's under to conform to regulations that were designed and made for large agribusinesses, and now he has to do all that. My brother's a farmer, so I'm really familiar with this, like the amount of paperwork he has to do, that I'm glad when Cargill has to do it, but for the small farmer, it's an impossible burden. And so, like, there's a radicalization that happens when we begin to act and think and live locally. So it's not...
Yes, Charles?
Right.
I want to do a little follow-up. I appreciate the fact that your brother is a farmer, therefore you're familiar with the Dark Act and many of the things that were designed from the get-go to benefit only one group, and that is the monolithic industrial farming community. We've seen virtually every administration from Carter to today only selecting people to run governmental agencies, the USDA, the FDA, the CDC, whatever it is. They're coming from corporations that profit from the policies that these people help shape or the rules that they can help bend or eliminate. And time and again, when I look at a person like Michael Taylor, the former top lawyer from Monsanto, who was selected then to go over by Obama to become head of food safety at the FDA. And at the same time, we have thousands of documents from that were brought out under Freedom of Information Act that showed that Monsanto knew for over a decade that many of its chemicals, including glyphosate, had questionable safety. This was hidden from the American people. Not a single thing was done. No investigation was upheld. So even when agencies that represent the larger corporate interest are found negligent or guilty, A, nothing happens. The worst that happens is they pay a fine, and that's part of the cost of doing business. But if your brother made mistakes, he's not going to be subsidized. There's no safety net. The risk that he takes each season in having to buy seeds, he's going to know he has to put down a winter crop like alfalfa that holds the green into the soil and therefore lessens the erosion in the spring. Most erosion occurs when there's no cover crop. The yep. ground has lost a lot when you grow corn. Corn is the largest loser, and behind that is soy, of nitrogen. And then one day you go down to the mouth of Mississippi, which I was down there filming, and the largest dead zone where there's no oxygen, and that's all from the high phosphorus fertilizers, it's all from the nitrogen fertilizers, synthetic fertilizers, from commercial farming, generally mono farming, one crop, and that's there, and you think, how did this happen with the regulatory agencies? At the same time that that gets no attention, unless it's from the alternative media, we're being told about a miracle new genetic sequencing that can help make a particular item more disease resistant. Just for your own edification, I had the first organic teaching farm in New York State, created the first food co-op at the High Falls Food Co-op back in 1971, and have taught probably 20,000 people to date, free, the importance of organic farming and conservation using natural principles. And back then, and I'll tell you how it was back then, a friend of mine owned Fairway Supermarket, which was a very successful food supermarket, right up there with Balducci's and probably the most successful in America as an individual supermarket. And I said, Dave, how about trying some organic produce? He said, fine, bring it down. We'll try it. So I brought down a bunch of organic produce. And then let's just say, for example, that a normal head of lettuce was a dollar. He priced it at 75 cents. And we had a big sign, fresh, locally grown, organic, non-sprayed produce. Nobody bought it. And this went on for about 3 months. And I walked in one Saturday. I said, how's it going? He said, well, not so good, Gary. He said, seems like nobody wants this. I said, maybe it's the price. He said, no, Gary. I priced it at half price for the last month, meaning 50% off our regular sprayed produce, and I couldn't give it away. And boy, that puzzled me. Here we're giving fresh organic produce at 50% discount, so you couldn't say it was too expensive, and people wouldn't buy it. So as Helena said earlier, and I'm going to ask her in a moment to respond to this, at some point, should we not also have concomitant with a movement back to a more natural way of thinking, living, and coexisting, coming from love and peace and harmonizing our energies, shouldn't we also ask people to at least examine how responsible their own conditioning has been and their freedom of choice has been in making some of the very choices that caused us to get into this mess? And can they not also now with new awareness and new mindfulness begin to make healthier choices? Or do we just wait till there's a disaster, till there's a fire in Northern California that's wiped out 8,700 homes, caused over 40 deaths, and finally someone says, A, why did a developer have the right to develop land that they knew was in a permanent fire zone? Why were they given permits where there was no inclusion of fire alarm systems that could inform people of gigantic fire extinguishing systems? Why didn't they have building codes where the buildings had to have fire water carriages on the outside so the whole house could be soaked within 5 minutes of a fire alarm going off? Why none of this happening? Well, then you look at your political system. Why wasn't this in the media? It was no secret. This was not the first time Northern California, Sonoma, and Napa Valley had been devastated. It happened in 1961, happened in the 1970s, happened again. It's going to happen again. It's getting hotter. Why is it always when someone is living where they shouldn't, when they're in a wet zone, they're in a flood zone, they're in a hurricane zone, why is it that we never ask people to be responsible for the choice they're making? Why not look for a more sustainable place to live and therefore have society and the government help people making that move, not to an urban environment, as you were suggesting, is that likely outcome that many of us, yourself, myself, agree does not have to be, but rather to a more sustainable environment where you don't have all the congestion? I don't believe that we have spread the question wide enough that we, the people, are also part of both the problem and the solution. That said, Charles, I'm coming back to Alina in a moment. Please address this, if you will. You touched upon something that I believe is the heart of everything. I believe that all issues are spiritual issues. And one is the fact that we give too little importance to the small acts of kindness and compassion and even small behavioral changes that, however minute, still contribute to the good and the just, even if they appear to have little impact on the greater whole of a society. And this lesson, I believe, we must all learn, and we must speak it frequently. And somehow, in order to have a real positive and lasting impact on the world, we need to live on the margins of the dominant worldview that is destroying the planet today. That means adopting a new worldview. Or to you it's not new, to Alina it's not new, to many people it's not new, but to the average person it is. Would you say then that we have to have a new story? And this is something George Monbiot has been emphasizing of lately. And Americans are addicted to an old story with progress, capitalism, a manifest destiny, framed in Christian myth. And I'm deeply disappointed that we have not thought deeper as a society, especially our so-called critical thinkers. And also, would this not be better than the psychobabble or the faux democracy or the selfish interpretations of freedom as their sky gods to worship? And I'm sure our listeners now know the old story too well. I comment and deconstruct that story on a daily basis. But I would like to have you both address this, if you would, please. Are we not now witnessing, if we choose to, the emergence of a grassroots and local level reconnection with what is authentic, what is spiritual, and what is natural? And at the level among those who have pulled back the curtain on our oligarchical and militaristic culture and know who the real Oz is, and how is this story related to our need to connect with a greater force of truth within ourselves in order to be motivated and exact change? Please continue.
Do you want me to first or Helena? I'm happy either way.
Helena, would you like to take a crack at this, please?
Okay, yes. I do have here quite a different perspective because from my point of view, with my experiences in about a dozen countries, speaking seven languages or so, I am seeing more than anything a way in which people are being manipulated into living in unsustainable cities, living where developers plan for them to live, living in a way that the entire system encourages. I'm seeing people frightened about being able to survive in a system where they're so cut off from one another. They're trained to see themselves as separate individuals, completely separate from others and from the living earth, pulled into ever larger cities, and every single thing they need, a drop of water, a kindness, a massage, a smile virtually, everything they need now costs money. Now, that money is of no stable value. They don't know if tomorrow a loaf of bread is going to cost, you know, 10% more, 20% more. There is a structural relationship between a mass urbanization, fragmentation of community, and a blind attachment to earning more money and at virtually any cost. I'm seeing an epidemic of anxiety and depression among young people. It's so sad and it's so tragic that this is linked to an artificial creation of unemployment. Unemployment never existed until this modern industrial system, which favored the few over the many. So I would like us to absolutely emphasize the incredible and fundamental importance of recognizing the inherent spiritual interconnectedness of everything that lives, our connectedness to others, our connectedness to the plants, to the animals. And if we can just be open, you know, let our hearts be open to feeling that, that's an incredibly vital and important empowerment. However, I want to see that linked to an economic and political big picture analysis so that we can also link together and change the structures that are blindly manipulating us in the wrong direction. And when I say blindly, I'm talking about the fragmentation, you know, that Charles is addressing, you know, with a narrow focus on climate change, which ends up, it's being constructed by giant corporations. The absolutely clear message to people out there, including those who are voting for Trump and voting for Le Pen and around the world, the clear message needs to be the same monopolistic structures that are driving up CO2 emissions and putting you in a cage-like situation where you have almost no choice but to keep driving your car and buying things that are triple wrapped in plastic and so on. That same system threatens your job, threatens your livelihood, threatens your sense of identity. I think we have a big picture, which is, it's not a make-believe picture. It's a picture where we look at the world and we can, particularly when we go outside of the boundaries of the industrialized world to less industrialized parts of the world, if we open our eyes, we will see that almost half the population is still on the land. So number one, that means I want the left to take food and farming and the land more seriously than they tend to do. There's a tragic way that the left has ended up on the wrong side of these issues in many cases. And I want us to look at how, when we address the universal issues of our deep interconnectedness with one another, our longing for being seen, heard, and loved, you know, as children in particular, this is a universal human need to feel that you belong to a community, to a sense of that interconnectedness and oneness with others, but also with nature. Once we wake up to that and we speak a language that is not too specialized and not too frightening for as it were, you know, the average person living in rural Texas or Kentucky, when we speak the language of universal needs and values, I think we can bring people together across the artificial divide of environment or people, left or right, men or women. There is a big picture that can bring people together, and I really hope that we will, you know, we won't compartmentalize the spiritual and those smaller acts of kindness in a separate category,
Helena,
the political path to that.
Helena, I would I believe that you're being contrary without first understanding what I said. We actually believe in the same thing there, but maybe I did not explain it in a way that you could appreciate. I was suggesting that everything comes from the spiritual. If I'm making any decision, political, economic, if I'm looking for a role model, I'm not going to find that role model within the current corporate hierarchical structure. The media supports the hierarchical structure. Academia supports it. When was the last time you saw 100,000 professors and a million teachers go on strike to change not just student debt and ask it for be forgiven, but also the nature of the curriculum, how it's taught, who's behind it, who writes it, who benefits from it? When was the last time the 920,000 physicians in the United States decided to go on strike to prove that medicine should be about healing and listening and empathy and patience and understanding that if you're doing something that's not working, you shouldn't be rewarded consistently for failure? And that's been our war on cancer, our war on mental health, our war on diabetes and heart disease. None of the victories that we've had have come from the medical community. They've come from those who are outside the medical community who are learning prevention. But to do that, I do not believe that you can have we who are growing integrate within an existing system that every time anyone tries to do it, even a Dennis Kucinich, who's now a Fox contributor, who was extremely progressive in Congress, one of the most progressive, and now he's muted himself substantially. I believe that there's an individual movement with hundreds of millions of people worldwide, because I also travel the world, and I'm looking at people who are learning how to first start off with who are they as a human being. Not just what are they, not just what object do they possess, not just what how they've been conditioned, but to understand the power of that conditioning and how it's made their choices limited. I use the example of people living in Northern California or other places where they're in harm's way and with even the slightest knowledge, slightest research, would have known that it's not are you in harm's way, it's when will the accident happen that gets your attention. It's no different than I'm counseling tens of thousands of people in nutrition. Do I have to wait till a person shows up in my office with their heart attack or stroke or cancer before they finally say, I got it. Okay, I got it. There's an intentional neglect. There's an intentional, as Fritz Perl, the father of Gestalt, said, a fear of knowing is a fear of doing. I believe that we have far more awareness at the individual level than what we're giving ourselves credit for, but we do not take into account laziness, selfishness. We don't start with everyone being perfect and pure at the conditioned level. And self-interest. And then how many people intentionally align themselves? Look, we just had 100 million people who didn't vote and 126 million people voted for the worst of two evils. And a million people, only 1% voted for the one person who could have changed everything. And that's Jill Stein. But she got only 1%. That tells me not about Jill Stein or a Ralph Nader, or Rocky Anderson before her. It tells me about what people are not willing to commit to. And my job as a person who looks into this, as one of many who looks into it, is to ask what questions do we have to begin to ask ourselves, and at what level are we asking the self? Because if you just ask someone to change their diet before changing their beliefs, you're going to have a failed diet. If you're asking someone to change their economic picture before asking themselves what is the value of money and who besides myself can that money help, then they're not going to learn the lesson. If you're saying, do we have a shortage of food, or do we have a shortage of land, or do we have a shortage of understanding of how the food we have could feed the people if we went to a plant-based diet? So I'm looking at this from a spiritual perspective. If you consider me compartmentalizing spirituality, then that indeed we would share a difference of opinion. And I respect you for your opinion because you're giving us your insights. And I value the ability for you to share those insights. So thank you for that. But if you think we're different on looking at the world that has been corporatized, propagandized from Edward Bernays, the father of American propaganda, and I'm saying we don't. We're not on the opposite side. We just may have a little different approach, but I believe we have to be open to all approaches and see what works. I'd like your input on this now, Charles, please. Your turn.
So I think that this matter of spirituality gets at a realization that many of us have had, which is that the crisis before us and the change that we need to make goes all the way to the bottom. It's not just a matter of reforming existing systems, but it's a transformation, a transformation in our very way of being human, our way of relating to each other, our identity, who we think we are, why we think we're here, what the purpose of life is, how to be a man, how to be a woman, and how to relate to nature and reality outside of us. So a lot of what we see as normal is a product of these deep stories, this mythology that goes much beyond just Christian mythology. It includes the mythology of science. So you were talking about the small private acts, which seem pointless in, you know, in the tide of globalization and climate change. But that pointlessness is based in part on a certain theory of change that takes for granted a random force-based universe that, and a nature outside of ourselves that does not fully possess the qualities of a self. That's just a bunch of it's a melee of forces and masses and generic particles upon which humans impose our design and against which humans erect barriers of control and seek to dominate. Because if it's just a bunch of random forces, then human well-being comes through dominating those random forces. And if we're in a world of competitors, then your personal well-being comes through dominating the competitors. So this is the water in which we swim in this culture. And to preempt Helena's point, it's not just that the story or the ideology generates the systems and the culture. It works the other way, too. If we are in a money economy that already disconnects us from the source of our food, our clothing, our shelter, disconnects us from everything, then it's very natural, normal for us to see the world through that lens. To see the world, I mean, it sure looks like everybody's out for themselves. It sure looks like what happens to nature need not affect me because I can move somewhere else because I'm so distanced and abstracted from the ecology. So this situation sometimes has us see symptoms as causes because the causes are invisible. So even some of the things you mentioned, like laziness, selfishness, greed, hypocrisy, these present themselves as a bad thing to go to war against, but we could also see them as symptoms. Like greed is a symptom of the perpetual insecurity that is generated by our economic system. Laziness is a symptom, perhaps, of a loss of meaning that and a loss of a connection between one's desire to contribute to something greater than themselves and any meaningful thing greater than themselves. So, or laziness is a form of rebellion that says, yeah, I'm not going to work hard. So, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you can take it to that level too. Yes, it's all part of the one giant matrix. And that means that, you know, there's a saying, you can't change one thing without changing everything. But if you can change one thing, everything will change. So I think that each of us is invited, according to our capacities and temperament, toward different expressions of our universal desire to be part of, to contribute to a more beautiful world. And some people might be more called to act on a political level, some on a more personal level. Ultimately, a well-rounded person will at least have some engagement on every level. Otherwise, you get the stereotype of the environmental activist who, you know, neglects his family, or the you know, kind person who is oblivious to politics, etc. So I think that we all should and ultimately want to have engagement on every level, but in a certain phase of life, something will call to your care and direct that care to something specific. And I think that, just to finish here and turn it back to the ecological level, and the level of farming and soil, ultimately the regenerative agriculture revolution is saying that we have to become intimate with every piece of land that we're at, that we can't necessarily apply a permaculture formula or some formula that was developed in Austria or Australia or somewhere to this land right here, because it's not a generic substance. It's an absolutely unique individual. And so to relate to the world as composed of interrelated, interdependent, interexistent, unique individuals is a very different perception than the one fostered by a commodity economy that makes everything the same, a standardized education system that tries to make all people the same, a medical system that fosters a mechanical view of the body that makes them all the same. Like, that's one way to characterize revolution. It's a revolution back into intimacy. I could go on, but I'll stop.
For both of you, we're coming up to the end of the program, and I just like people to understand that all of these are ideas. All we can do is share ideas. If they seem reasonable, try them. If they seem inappropriate, them. But we need to do more critical thinking. We need more introspection. We need more time to understand that we're not commodities. Our value is not just in what we own or what we possess or how much money we make or our achievements. We may have mastered our career. It doesn't mean we've mastered our life. I'm saying from my own perspective, the people who are most likely to take everything into consideration, where they create balance in their life, they want to be aware of the environment and their impact on it. They want to be aware of the importance of their diet and hence eat things that prevent the disease that they wouldn't later have to fight over universal health care, which should be a mindful process, or whether it's one of these for-profit endeavors that currently we are involved in. They want to prevent the disease. They want to help other people. They don't want to go to war. So you start unraveling that thread of conscious awareness. And wow, it goes through every one of what was previously considered a compartmentalized life. And then one day you just see everything for what it is and you can make appropriate choices. At least they're your choices. They're not someone else's convincing you by constant and repetitive advertisement. You got to make that choice because you were told that's the choice you got to make. And I believe that is what Helena and all of her great work, and Helena, you've done magnificent work, and I commend you for all your good work. And Charles, the same. We're all coming to this by sharing our ideas. And I'll end with this. This is just in today, and I don't know if you're aware of this. This is from the journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution, and it says, quote, "A new study suggests that standard ways of measuring well-being and sustainability in communities used by global organizations may be missing critical information and could lead to, let's say, missteps in management actions." And the paper, done by a team of 40 scientists and policymakers and on-the-ground practitioners, suggest alternatives and complementary approaches that use indications grounded in the value of a particular community. Quote, "Well-being is a universality applicable concept. Yet, because it can mean so many different things to different people, that unfortunately, printing it down an exact definition is difficult. And that's why we must understand people should be looked upon for what they can do to maximize health, happiness, joy in their own communities, and then share that as they can." And I certainly agree with that. I believe that we should be looking at what we can share with each other that empowers us, enlivens us, helps us, but there must be a universality, meaning for me to have a truth, it must also register with universal truth. So if my child should not starve to death, I shouldn't be concerned about the 26,000 that are dying every 24 hours from different diseases and malnutrition and infections. If I do not want someone droning my house and killing my child, I should not want anyone else's house or child to be droned and killed. I believe we must start to connect with that universal spiritual energy. And that's all the time we have. Thank you very much for being on today. I really appreciate you taking your time out of your schedules to share your insights with us.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks so much for the work you're doing.
And everyone, thank you for listening. This has been A Conversation with Remarkable Minds. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.